the Shore Shame Podcast, shining a light to the nations.
Well, shalom once again, everybody. I'm Bill Cloud, and welcome to this week's Torah Tidbit. This week, it's taken from the portion called Balak. Balak is the name that was given to the king of Moab, who, when Israel crossed along his border, he decided to call upon a well-known heathen prophet by the name of Balaam to come and to curse the people of God. And this is recorded for us in Numbers chapter 22, beginning in verse 2 and 3. It says this, "Now Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was exceedingly afraid of the people because they were many. And Moab was sick with dread because of the children of Israel. Then he sent messengers to Balaam," or Balaam, "the son of Beor at Pethor, saying, 'Look, a people has come from Egypt. See, they cover the face of the earth and are settling next to me. Therefore, please come at once. Curse this people for me, for they are too mighty for me. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed.'" And so obviously, Balaam was renowned in the ancient world and had, apparently anyway, been successful at blessing certain people or certain nations or cursing people or nations. And so having this information, Balak called for him and promised him great fortune and honor if he would make the journey from Mesopotamia to Moab and rid him of these people that he considered to be such a great threat to his kingdom. Now, as we read the Torah portion, it becomes apparent that Balaam, though he was considered a heathen prophet from Mesopotamia, nevertheless, Balaam is aware of the one true God and at times converses with him. And so we have to conclude that somehow and at some point, Balaam, though a heathen, was taught about the one true God. And there are other instances that we can see in Scripture where there are these scattered worshipers of God, Melchizedek, Job, Jethro, are just a couple of examples. Nonetheless, Balaam is still regarded as a heathen sorcerer. Now, he definitely had a prophetic gift. There's no doubt about that. And we know that he had knowledge of the truth. But like many who would follow in his footsteps, he perverted all of that for his own personal gain. Now, we read in the Torah portion that he ultimately blessed Israel. However, his intention becomes clear, and that was to curse Israel. And thus he is called in rabbinic sources Balaam the Wicked. And his disciples are those who are said to have a haughty mind, a proud spirit, and an evil eye. And he and those like him are associated with people like Amalek and Haman, and so are to be regarded as an arch enemy of Israel. So infamous is Balaam that even in the New Testament, we see a warning about his disciples. Peter said this, "They have forsaken the right way and gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness." And we also see in Jude, "Woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah." Now, even the Messiah himself talks about Balaam in Revelation chapter 2, beginning at verse 14. He said this, "But I have a few things against you, because you have there those who hold to the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit sexual immorality." And so that's a key phrase there, stumbling block. And that helps us to answer this question. What makes Balaam and his kind so dangerous to God's people? Because though they on one hand seem to bless God's people and even realize that God is with Israel, nevertheless, they are continually devising a way to infiltrate God's people and to destroy them. In chapter 23 of Numbers, Bilaam said this, "He has not observed iniquity in Jacob," that is, God has not observed this iniquity, "nor has he seen wickedness in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among them." Now, this verse and the phrase, "has not observed iniquity," has interesting implications as far as I'm concerned. Because speaking for himself, Bilaam, who has looked for a reason to curse Israel, can't find one. From God's point of view, Israel is a nation without any spot or any stain. Apparently, from God's point of view, they have committed no sin that would warrant the removal of God's blessing. Now, that's a very interesting thing to consider, because we know that they most definitely in the past had sinned mightily against God. So I think we have to conclude that even though they had sinned and they had angered God, he is not going to allow someone else to curse them, or he's not going to allow someone else to destroy them and to observe their faults. Now, here's why this is important to you and me. This helps us understand how God views us and how the adversary is wanting to come after us. In other words, the adversary wants to destroy us. He wants to curse us. But I am firmly of the opinion that if God has blessed us, the adversary does not have the ability to curse us, even though he wants to desperately. You see, because the Lord his God is with him, that means that no weapon formed against him shall prosper. Bilaam found this to be true, and instead of just leaving it at that, he determined that the best way to harm Israel is not to curse them, because he can't, but to entice Israel to sin. You see, if the adversary can't curse what God has blessed, then he will try to seduce those that God has blessed to sin. And if they are led astray by that seduction, they'll end up doing to themselves what their enemies don't have the power to do. You just have to consider the method of the serpent in the midst of the garden, how he seduced the woman and the man to sin. Consider how Sanballat wanted to get into the midst of Nehemiah and the Jews in order to kill them, using the guise of wanting to bless them, because he said, "I want to help you." You see, the reason the adversary has always utilized this tactic is because he can't curse what God has blessed, but also because God's people keep falling for it. I firmly believe that the black arts have no power over God's people. I don't believe that God's people should fear a witch's curse as some people do. God delivered Israel from Egypt by his might, not by magician's tricks. In fact, the rod of Aaron devoured the rod of the Egyptian magicians. Balak's attempt to employ a sorcerer, a witch if you will, to curse a blessed nation with magic was futile because that blessed nation repudiated magic and heathen spells. But that is not to say that the adversary is powerless to attack us or to try to oppress us. No, he can do those things, and I am convinced that sometimes he does it successfully. But I'm also convinced that he doesn't have the power to reverse what God has instituted. If he could do that, wouldn't he be considered more powerful? But to the contrary, what does Messiah say to this issue? "Behold, I give you the authority to trample on serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall by any means hurt you." When it became obvious that Balaam was not going to do what Balak had hired him to do, "I want you to come curse these people, but you keep blessing them," he finally asked the prophet to just keep quiet. If you can't curse them and you're going to bless them, well, just hush. That was more or less his message. Now, had Balaam parted ways with Balak at that point, perhaps Balaam would not now be considered the villain that he is, but he didn't do that. He is so desperate to get a hold of the glory and the wealth, he decides that if he can't curse Israel, then he would get them to bring a curse upon themselves. And so Balaam laid out a plan for Balak. And the plan given to Balak was in perfect harmony with the time-tested methods of the adversary. Again, the adversary can't curse what God has blessed, but he has the ability and the skill to seduce Israel into cursing themselves. His methods have always included this tactic and always include something that appeals to the eye of God's people. I mean, consider the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Consider the sons of God in Genesis 6, how the adversary used the beautiful daughters of men in the days leading up to the great flood. And so in this story, here again, this tactic is used, and to some degree, very successfully. He uses something or someone that's enticing enough to lure God's people away from the truth and to embrace something that is false. Now, I want you to meditate upon something that's very important related to us in this particular Torah portion, and that is this. The leaders of Moab and Midian were so intent on destroying Israel that they were willing to send their own daughters to physically seduce the men of Israel. That's pretty committed. Unfortunately, many Israelites accepted the invitation of these beautiful women of Moab and of Midian and joined with them in a sacrificial meal at Baal Peor, as recorded for us in Numbers chapter 25. And Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit harlotry with the daughters of Moab. For they called the people unto the sacrifice of their gods. And the people did eat and bowed down to their gods. And Israel joined himself to Baal Peor, and the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel. Now I want you to notice that they lured them with their beauty. Then they enticed them to eat food that had been sacrificed to an idol. And then they engaged in this licentious behavior after the meal. Thus, these men of Israel joined themselves, and that word literally means yoked themselves to this idol, just as a woman would yoke herself to her husband. In fact, the word Baal or Baal means husband. And in the end, Israel did to themselves what the adversary could not do to them. It's just that the adversary is very good at setting the trap that God's people have so often walked into. So the point of all this today is to demonstrate that God's people must always be aware that there are enemies who are intent upon destroying us. And those enemies will come to realize that they are powerless to curse us. Like Balaam, they possess or may possess a genuine gift, but lack the proper virtues to refrain from misappropriating those gifts for personal gain. And to attain that personal gain, they will oftentimes mean for them that God's people must be moved out of the way. And so that's why they have to devise a plot. Most importantly, we learned that the adversary, though he cannot curse God's people because God has blessed them, the adversary knows very well the weaknesses of God's people, and he is very skilled at how to lay a snare. Therefore, you and I would do well to remember the admonishment of Paul, who said this in the book of Ephesians, chapter 6, beginning in verse 11. Put on the whole armor of God, that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but we wrestle against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand, stand. So, ladies and gentlemen, we need to realize that these words are very important for us because the adversary's out there trying to lay this snare. He can't curse what God has blessed, but he can be successful if we allow him to bring upon ourselves that which he is unable to do. If we do not take on the whole armor of God, we will inevitably fall into his trap. Remember, you can't curse what God has blessed, but those who have been blessed of God must commit ourselves not to bring that curse upon ourselves. Thanks for joining me today in this week's Torah Tidbit. Hope you're blessed. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.